freedom. My name is M1. I'm half of the legendary Tell It Like It Is, Everything Is Political rap duo Dead Prez. And this is WPFW, Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
Kick of U.S. imperialism, if you talk about wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya, which has led to our tax dollars being poured down a rat hole, which has led to many of our finest brothers and sisters being slaughtered on foreign battlefields, Britain has been the major sidekick of the United States. And so what happens in Britain is of maximum importance to our lives here.
Gerald Horn returns from London with news and perspectives on the European Union. Also, Lori Wallach of Public Citizen on the global corporate grab that is the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And Medea Benjamin talks about organizing against war and militarism.
So literally, what we're fighting right now is a consolidation and locking of corporate power under the disguised brand of trade agreements that could affect all of our futures, but those of millions of people around the planet.
All that and more coming up on the Ground. Good morning, DMV. Welcome to On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital on 89.3 WPFW, your listener-powered station for jazz and justice. I'm Esther Avarim, and I want to sincerely thank everyone who supported WPFW's spring membership drive, especially those who supported On the Ground in our new time slot on Friday morning. Well, as always, we have a jam-packed show today. Gerald Horn just returned from London, and he gives us an exclusive report back on what's happening there and on other current events abroad and here. Then we'll present two more voices from the recent Breaking Through Power mobilization here in D.C., more about how the TPP or Trans-Pacific Partnership that President Obama is pushing, like it's like the last Christmas tree to sell on December 24th, how this deal is a massive global corporate grab. And then finally, Medea Benjamin of Code Pink will speak on the state of the United States and war. So let's get right to it. My talk with Gerald Horn will make up our news and headlines for this week. We'll be right back with Gerald. For this segment, to talk about what's happening in the world, I'm joined by writer and activist Professor Gerald Horn, who's a frequent contributor to this show and Across the Pacifica Network. Good morning, Gerald.
Good morning to you.
So I want to talk about London, and I think that many of the same issues impacting Americans are impacting people in Great Britain. A stagnant economy, controversies about immigration policies, and environmental concerns like fracking. So what are your biggest takeaways from your visit?
What's interesting is that those in favor of the so-called Brexit or the British exit from the European Union have taken an increasingly hostile approach to immigration. They charge that being part of the European Union means that Britain does not and cannot have control over its borders. They charge that Britain is being inundated with immigrants. Reading the newspapers in London while I was there a few days ago, particularly the Daily Mail, it seemed that not a day would pass without a picture of immigrants flooding into Europe from Syria, just a few hundred miles across the Mediterranean Sea. And what's striking, of course, is that Prime Minister David Cameron, the Tory Prime Minister, who is in favor of Britain remaining in the European Union, was also a hawk with regard to the overthrow of the Gaddafi regime, which has now helped to create, we are told, this immigration crisis. In any case, I think that there are a couple of other points that listeners should be aware of. One is that apparently those in favor of Brexit, the British exit, are embarrassed to tell pollsters that, and so it's unclear how many people or what the percentage of voters there are in Britain who support Brexit. I think this is relevant to the U.S. presidential election because social scientists are now telling us that many of the Donald Trump supporters are reluctant to tell pollsters that they're supporting Trump. Apparently they feel embarrassed to do so, for good reason, I might add. And so therefore we might not have a handle on Trump's actual range of support, just like we don't have a handle on the range of support for Brexit. In any case, the rise of this anti-immigration movement in Britain is of a piece with the rise of anti-immigration movements throughout Western Europe, including Germany and the Netherlands and France, and I might also say the United States of America, which is rather ironic. The point that I would make further is that the New York Times had an article just a few days ago, which in many ways was reflecting the sentiments of on the ground, believe it or not. That is to say that they are saying that there is a rising global fascist movement, including in the United States of America, as reflected in the Trump train movement. But what was striking about this New York Times article is that on the one hand, their talk program, to its credit, has been discussing for months now, but they did not deign to mention the state terror and the police terror against black people in Baltimore, in Staten Island, in Cleveland, and the non-state actor terrorism against black people in Charleston, South Carolina, the Trayvon Martin case in Florida. And so it makes one wonder, what are they trying to tell us? That black people's lives don't matter? That when you talk about fascism, you can't talk about black people. And what's even more ironic is that the U.S. press, particularly the New York Times, is clamoring for regime change in Venezuela and in Brazil as well. And when that happens, or if that happens, I should say, then the working class movements in those countries will be weakened, which means that U.S. capital would be able to move south of the border, which would further enrage many Euro-American working class people in any case, making them more susceptible to the blandishments of Donald J. Trump, which the same elite press tells us they're opposed to.
It's funny you mentioned the articles because I was going to ask you about it. But in terms of London also, you know, I read a few reports saying that there's a generational divide about the Brexit, about the UK leaving the European Union. And so I wonder what your thoughts are and why should people in the U.S. care at all or at least be watching what's happening?
Well, that second question is easy to answer. The sidekick of U.S. imperialism, if you talk about wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya, which has led to our tax dollars being poured down a rat hole, which has led to many of our finest brothers and sisters being slaughtered on foreign battlefields, Britain has been the major sidekick of the United States. And so what happens in Britain is of maximum importance to our lives here. But not only that, I think it's fair to say that if Britain exits from the European Union, it could lead to an unraveling of the EU as a whole. And my own opinion is that unraveling is probably good news for people of African descent in the first place. So I think that this is of maximum importance to all of us. Now, with regard to the divides on Brexit, once again, I'm going by the polls, and the pollsters, by their own admission, don't necessarily believe what they're reporting because they're saying people are not being honest. But what they're telling us is that oftentimes older people and people outside of London are in favor of Brexit. And London, which is a cosmopolitan capital, not only in terms of Britain but globally, is generally in favor of remaining in the European Union. Apparently, black British are in favor of remaining in the European Union because, from their point of view, the anti-immigration movement that characterizes Brexit is rather frightening, a sentiment that I wholly and totally understand.
And you've given me some information I didn't have before in terms of the relationship to the Brexit forces and anti-immigration forces in London, but I guess unlike other European countries, I haven't heard a lot about the emergence of like ultra-right candidates in the UK. You know, instead I hear about Jeremy Corbyn being elected to head the Labour Party, and London recently elected the first Muslim mayor. But what were your impressions of the political trends there and compared to the rest of Europe that we've seen?
Well, I think it's very similar. I mean, first of all, you have the UK Independence Party, which is in favor of Brexit, and it's a right-wing populist party, not unlike the Trump train movement in the United States of America. Not only that, but my own opinion is, as of today, that there is at least a 50-50 chance that irrespective of the vote on Brexit, that Prime Minister David Cameron will be ousted by an internal party coup before the end of the year. That's because the Conservatives, the party that he represents, are split on Brexit. And the pro-Brexit forces, the forces in favor of Britain exiting the European Union, are saying that unless Brexit fails, by, say, 6-4 or 7-3, they're going to lead a coup against David Cameron, and he'll be toast. He'll be out of there, and a more right-wing prime minister will emerge in London. And that's not good news, because one of my other takeaways from London and from Europe in general is that this loose talk about war with Russia, I mean, you would think that this is a definition of insanity, given that Russia is a nuclear power, Britain is a nuclear power, the United States is a nuclear power. The relations have plummeted, and a leading British official who had been a leader of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, has written this novel that's apparently selling like hotcakes about war with Russia in 2017. It's very frightening. It's very scary. And I dare say that it'll come a step closer to reality if this internal party coup is led against David Cameron. However, if that coup takes place, there will probably have to be new elections in Britain before the end of the year, and that may be the opportunity for Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party to step forward. At least let's hope so.
You know, you mentioned that New York Times article about fascism, and I assume it's the same one as I think was by Peter Baker on May 28th? So, one odd thing I thought about it, you know, speaking of European leaders, is that they, of course, they kind of lumped together Putin and Erdogan of Turkey and as strongmen, and giving this as their definition of one of their, as part of their definition for fascism. And that's really something that we haven't really used at all. We've really kind of talked about the basically the corporate takeover of government, you know, when there's almost no delineation between what corporations are doing and what the government is doing. We've talked about brutality and state violence in relationship to the Black Lives Matter movement and tied that in. But I thought it was odd the type of definition the author used for fascism. It seemed to be very vague in terms of economics and that how they just, you know, grouped together what they considered strong men as opposed to really the, I guess, countries that have really waged the most violence around the globe, if we want to use the idea of someone being a strong, you know, or warlike leader.
Well, certainly there was a non-too-hidden agenda in the New York Times article by Peter Baker. In other words, by beating the drums with regard to fascism and raising the hackles, I'm sure, many of its readers who are justifiably and understandably concerned about the rise of fascism, they tried to smuggle in this anti-Moscow agenda and bring us one step closer some sort of confrontation with Russia. I mean, it was very deft how that was handled, while at the same time, as noted, totally omitting the question of police terror and state terror against black people and terror against black people by non-state actors. But not only that, recall the Eric Garner case of Staten Island, the paradigmatic case where the young black man is captured on tape being strangled to death by New York City police officers. The prosecutor who fails to bring an indictment then gets a promotion to Congress where he now sits. This is the sort of madness that somehow escaped that New York Times journalist.
Now, since we last spoke, The Intercept reported on leaked conversations between government and corporate officials in Brazil that confirmed for many the suspicion that Dilma Rousseff's impeachment was indeed a coup. And this week, you know, the secretary of the OAS proposed some action be taken against Maduro in Venezuela as opposed to against these officials in Brazil for staging this coup. And, you know, it kind of makes you wonder, you know, what secret meeting we missed, you know, in terms of trying to keep track of what's happening in the world. But what are your thoughts on the latest in Latin America?
Well, the Organization of American States that's headquartered in Washington, D.C., it seems to me that it's well past time for many of our friends in Washington to grace them with a picket line. Because obviously they're part of a very diabolical plot to engage in regime change in Caracas, Venezuela. What I'm really concerned about right now are the ripples emanating from Venezuela. What I mean is that they're just a few miles separating Venezuela from Trinidad and Tobago. And already there are stories about people being driven out of Venezuela because of the difficult conditions imposed by the Venezuelan mercantile elite assisted by U.S. imperialism in terms of lack of consumer goods, lack of toilet paper, electricity blackouts, etc. And that's putting a strain on the resources of tiny Trinidad and Tobago. Not only that, but President Maduro of Venezuela has recently visited Jamaica, and apparently the news that he delivered is the kind of subsidized oil deliveries that had been part and Venezuela's policy in the Caribbean might have to be curtailed or cut back, and that's obviously going to have a negative impact on the Jamaican economy. The same could be said for the Haitian economy and other economies as well in the Caribbean. And so, once again, it seems to me that this move against Venezuela is not just a move against Venezuela. It's a move in many ways against forces in the hemisphere as a whole.
Is there anything else you wanted to add from your trip? Or, you know, I do know the big primaries are coming up. Big primaries are coming up in the U.S. presidential race. I don't know if you have any thoughts on those before we go.
Well, the press keeps telling us that it's a done deal and that Hillary Rodham Clinton will be the presumptive nominee as of Tuesday in the early evening. I guess we shall see. But once again, one of the things that's concerning me now is this double standard and the curious omissions. Now, we just talked about that with regard to fascism and not talking about terror against black people, but there have been a spate of articles in the press complaining about black students on college campuses and supposedly how they're so sensitive. They want, say, Calhoun College at Yale, named after a slave owner, to be renamed, or that they're ultra-sensitive at Oberlin College, etc. But what's striking about that is the double standard, because the same press that's talking about black students being ultra-sensitive are basically saying that the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel is somehow offensive to pro-Israeli students and somehow needs to be curtailed. Now, this is very curious. It's a double standard, and here's another double standard as well. You might have seen the article in the New York Times a few days ago about Asian American actors complaining about the lack of parts and how novels that are used as source material for movies that have Asian characters, somehow they're changed to white characters when they enter the silver screen. But what's interesting is when you start to talk about so-called non-white actors being used in Hollywood, they oftentimes raise this red herring that black actors, for example, are not box office abroad. Well, they can't raise that about Asian American actors because the largest movie market today is in China. And not only that, but AMC Theaters, which is one of the largest movie chains in the United States, is actually owned by Chinese capital, Wanda Capital. And so those of us who are told that Hollywood is all about green and all about making money, I think we need a footnote or an amendment to say they're about green, but they're also about white and maintaining white supremacy, even in the face of profit sharing, believe it or not.
I've been speaking to Professor Gerald Horn, writer and activist, contributor to this show on Across the Pacifica Network. Thank you very much, Gerald, for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
We gon' be all right.
Now, while mainstream news organizations are jumping rather weakly onto the discussion of fascism bandwagon, especially when it comes to some of the social policies, tough guy stance, and racism of Donald Trump, none of these mainstream critiques look at what is happening economically, you know, that corporate control over government in the same light. But we've been talking about that here on the ground, especially when we consider the controversial Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty, which critics agree will give corporations more power than nation states and even of all the laws of those states. So I wanted you to hear Lori Wallach, Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, talking at the recent Breaking Through Power mobilization about the controversial Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty, or TPP. After Lori Wallach, you'll hear Medea Benjamin of Code Pink talking about war and also how it relates to the economy and the military-industrial complex.
Good afternoon, everybody. So the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, now here's a fight. We are going to win. And we are poised to stop the TPP because of amazing activism, not just here, probably a lot of you were involved, but in the other 11 countries, well, most of them, because some of them you go to jail if you're an activist. But in some of those countries, people have been on the streets fighting. And as a result, the TPP fight is happening now in the context that's the most auspicious to us, the moment of maximum accountability during a presidential election year. And it's a funny thing how all the candidates have come around to where the public is. The public knows that the TPP is a big corporate power tool that is going to undermine our democracy, offshore our jobs, push down our wages, and flood our kids with unsafe imported food, oh, and raise granny's medicine prices, all in one fell 900-page swoop. And given we got elections coming up, you're seeing some members of Congress actually saying the same thing. They have problems with the TPP. However, actually boxing and burying that agreement and starting the much overdue turnaround to a different kind of policy that actually makes the global economy have some rules that work for people on the planet, not just multinational corporations, is the task at hand. And that is the import of this fight on the TPP. So in a certain way, the hijack of U.S. trade agreements is maybe the worst case of corporate power breaking through. So we need to break through that corporate power by stopping what has become really a slow-motion coup d'etat against democratic governance. See, because the sneaky truth about TPP and most of these trade agreements is it's not really about trade. Trade's the least of it. In the whole big TPP text, those 900 pages of rules that are strongly and strictly enforced, only 6 of the 30 chapters actually have to do with things like tariffs or quotas or subsidies or customs rules. The rest of it has been turned into a delivery mechanism for a set of non-trade agenda items that are bad for our democracy, bad for our jobs, bad for our planet, bad for our access to affordable medicine, safe food, financial stability. A lot of it's stuff that couldn't happen in the sunshine of actual public discourse. So a whole bunch of policies that you thought as an activist you had killed that were being pushed in Congress, like some horrible zombie, come back in a chapter of TPP. And the problem is the TPP, like the other trade agreements, unlike domestic law, they don't have expiration dates. If we don't follow those rules, say our Supreme Court says we shouldn't, we face trade sanctions, even if our own courts say that the rules don't meet our Constitution. And how the hell did we get into this? Well, this, again, is the notion of corporations seeking power. The process got to this result. So back when I was just out of law school in 1990 and I first had the honor of getting to work with Ralph Nader, which was a very daunting, scary thing because it was Ralph Nader. And Ralph basically made the very astute observation that you always have to look at the process. Bad process leads to bad policy. And in this instance, we had a handful of corporations, well, not a handful, 500, who were serving as official U.S. trade advisors on negotiations that were otherwise secret. Congress was largely locked out. The public and the press were totally locked out. And in this mix of literally corporate advisors calling the shots on stuff that we were having big national debates on at the very moment, the price of medicines, food safety, the environment, behind closed doors, these rules were getting renegotiated. And the TPP is all of that, all that stuff that Ralph was the first, one of the first guys to realize was going on, this sneaky attack. It wasn't about trade. They were stealing the brand. Free trade agreement, everyone would salute to that. But actually, it was a whole different sneak attack agenda. And TPP is the culmination of that, which is why it is so critical that we stop it. But also, the TPP is, by its own supporters' admission, the model for the next century of trade rules globally. It is a docking agreement. So the rules of that agreement are the rules. If a country wants an agreement with the United States, they're not going to be setting negotiations for their own rules. They either need to get onto that or they're not invited. So literally, what we're fighting right now is a consolidation and lock-in of corporate power under the disguised brand of trade agreements that could affect all of our futures, but those of millions of people around the planet. So what is in that agreement that can help us defeat it? To think about it accurately, we need to help people understand it's not about trade. It's a delivery mechanism for a whole new set of corporate rights and powers, and then new constraints, new handcuffs on government ability to pass policies that we need to ensure the viability of the climate, to ensure economic justice, to ensure that our financial system doesn't have a huge crisis again, to ensure our food is safe, our products are safe. And at the heart of that is the investor-state dispute settlement system, the foreign investor rights that also are the actual incentive to offshore American jobs. You know that a trade agreement actually really has incentives to offshore jobs when the Cato Institute, the libertarian organization, calls these investor rules a subsidy on offshoring, a promotion on offshoring, by unfairly lowering the risk premium on foreign investors. Instead of making them buy investment insurance or think twice about going to a country that has no rule of law where their investment might be seized, instead the risk gets socialized onto us by setting up a system where instead of meeting our laws and having to go to our courts, foreign corporations investing here would get equal rights as our corporations, U.S. corporations someplace else would, to skirt domestic laws and courts and directly attack any government policy or action in front of a tribunal of three private sector attorneys, one of whom they literally choose and hire. They are the judges. Many of them rotate between suing governments for corporations and being judges in the investor state system. There are no conflict of interest rules. They are not paid salary. They're paid many hundreds per hour. And it does not matter if the domestic law being challenged is treating the domestic and foreign firms the same. If it's been passed by referendum or the Congress, or if the U.S. Supreme Court has said it's fine. If these three private sector attorneys decide it violates the rights and privileges granted to foreign investors in the agreement, they can order the U.S. government to pay unlimited sums of taxpayer dollars as damages to the investor for the violation of their rights. And not just for the actual damages, for what the company says are their lost future expected profits. Really. And there's no outside appeal. So this system at the heart of the TPP that is being proposed for the European agreement, the TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Agreement, this investor state system at the heart of these agreements is literally the formalization, consolidation of making corporations as powerful as nation state. They're not just people. They're a country. Because practically, this system elevates individual investors and corporations to equal status with an entire sovereign nation state that's signed an agreement. It gives an individual investor or corporation the right to privately enforce a public treaty against a sovereign nation for taking actions that its own courts say are fine, that treat domestic and foreign investors the same, but that have the problem of conflicting with the new rights and privileges granted to corporations in the agreement. And there are no commensurate rights or obligations that the corporations owe the governments. Countries can't start these cases against the governments. One way, corporations and investors can sue governments for undermining the new rights and privileges they get. That's at the heart of the TPP. Now, we have some agreements in the U.S. with that system, like NAFTA. But so far, we haven't in the U.S. had very many of these attacks because our agreements have been with countries that have very few investors here. 8,500 total investors, cross-registered, foreign investors who could use this with all of our agreements with this system. Overnight, the TPP would double this. Thousands of Japanese industrial companies, very large financial service firms, Australian mining firms and timber firms, overnight would have the right to use this system against us. If you go to tradewatch.org, our website, tradewatch.org, you can see those companies geo-mapped onto your communities, your states. And if the U.S. approved the European agreement, another four times expansion would occur. Which is to say we would literally give corporations, instruments to undermine our democracy concretely, specifically, and simultaneously raid our treasury. Scary enough, and it's just the tip of the iceberg, the TPP also rolls back the initial reforms on access to affordable medicine that the Democrats in Congress made George Bush make. No kidding. Doctors Without Borders has called this the worst trade agreement ever for access to affordable medicines. It includes provisions that would basically shut down Medicare Part D reform, i.e. the government bulk purchasing and negotiating for price reductions for medicine, the future of how we cut our drug costs. It would limit internet freedom. Groups like EFF and others, the ACLU, have pointed out the extreme copyright rules. The environmental groups, Sierra Club, Defenders of Wildlife, NRDC, groups like NRDC and Defenders of Wildlife, the administration said before the agreement, are against it. It rolls back the Bush-era environmental standards. And, of course, they're very worried about the investment rules because the main target of a lot of these challenges has been environmental rules. Right now under NAFTA, one of the Canadian provinces' freeze on fracking has been challenged as an investor state violation. And then you have the projection of a lot of waves of unsafe imported food. Oh, and then there's the ban on buy local. Under this agreement, not only would we be having the incentives to offshore our jobs and have Americans competing more directly with workers in Vietnam, one of the countries in the TPP who makes 65 cents an hour, but also we would see an offshoring of our tax dollars. Because under these rules, we can't have Buy American preferences. We can't give preference to investing our tax dollars in the U.S. for U.S. firms and U.S. workers when we buy goods and services. We have to treat every firm in every TPP country as if they were the same, which would undermine U.S. law starting in 1934 of giving preference to domestic firms, to say nothing of a great tool to create innovation. For instance, a lot of the fuel efficiency standards were originally conditions for procurement until a market was developed, and then it became national law. Now, systematically, we've seen a huge gap between the sales jobs for these kind of agreements, which are always sold as trade agreements. Do you ever get to hear about these corporate tribunals? You ever hear about that? No. What you hear is, this is for the Korea agreement, sadly, by the Obama administration, more exports, more jobs. And when that doesn't work, you hear, China's going to get us. Don't look over here, squirrel. What you never hear about is what's actually in the agreements. And so just think of the last agreement, the Korea agreement. 4-year anniversary was just last month. That agreement was sold as the fix on NAFTA. They fixed all those problems in NAFTA. We're not going to get the problems NAFTA gave us. This is President Obama's brand new, shiny, fancy labor rights, environmental rights, everything rights trade agreement. And we're going to get more jobs. That was the deal, right? We all remember that. That agreement served as the template for the TPP. They literally offered that as the opening offer for the U.S. What's happened? Our exports actually declined 9%. It's the first time in like the history of trade agreements. We cut 10,000 tariffs, 80% in day one, and our exports dropped. Our trade deficit has doubled in 4 years with Korea. So that equates to about 100,000 more U.S. jobs lost if you use the multiplier that was used to promise the agreement would create jobs. And it's pretty systematic with our agreements. We know what the TPP is going to do. So let's talk about how we're going to kill it. Here is the really good news. Right now, our whole country is becoming hip to the fact that corporations have way too much power in Washington over our day-to-day lives, and one of the most concrete emblems of that are these runaway trade agreements. The most powerful tool we have is to get the word out about what the agreements are. The TPP is a massive corporate power tool, and nothing makes that more obvious than those corporate tribunals. It literally makes companies the same as a nation state. Getting the word out and using the materials that you can find on Expose the TPP, www.exposethetpp, great fact sheets, great action ideas, on tradewatch.org, getting the word out to our friends, our neighbors. And then number two, because this is an agreement, and again, I learned so much of everything I know from Ralph, the Dracula strategy works really well in this agreement. This is an agreement that only lives into the future if it can hide in the dark. If we drag this agreement into the sunshine, it is not going to become, is never going to go into effect. So getting the word out, and the polling shows people don't know a lot of what TPP is. They don't even know what the initial is. But when they hear about the contents, they become an opponent. Number two, this fight's going to be won or lost in the U.S. House of Representatives. Good news is right now, they don't have the votes. And that's because a lot of people have been working really hard for 4 years. They almost couldn't pass the trade authority for this damn agreement. That's because a lot of people did the hard work district by district, house member by house member. 5-vote difference. 5 more members voted no, there would have been no authority to finish this agreement. So already, 2 of the members who voted yes, 2 Republicans, have announced their no's. Which is wonderful. The narrowing gap. And so what we all need to do is basically we all need to see our members of the House of Representatives, every single one of us, Democrat or Republican, and we need to make sure that they are committed to voting no on the TPP. Because here's what everyone needs to know. Here's the strategy. They can't pass it under normal circumstances. The plan is to try and railroad it through in the lame duck session after the election. They want to go to the time of minimum accountability to lock in the most rigged trade rules in the history of the country. They want the recently fired and the already retired, who are all thinking about their next job, to be voting not for their constituents, but under a lack of accountability. And that is their main hope of how they weasel this thing through by one vote. At tradewatch.org, there is actually a guide to how to set up a meeting and how to prepare to get some of your friends to come with you. And just eyeball them and say, whatever is the issue that motivates you, will you commit to me that you will vote no and announce now you will vote no on the TPP? Tell them, I'm for trade. Who's not for trade? I will not allow this expansion of corporate rule to ruin my future and our country's future, and I expect you to stand up for me. Get their commitment. If we build the majority, they will not even start this vote. They will not go for this vote in the lame duck unless they can count in advance that they have the vote, because they do not want to risk it actually officially getting defeated. And what we have going right now is a national bipartisan trade revolt. Presidential candidates on the warpath against the agreement. The word getting out. The Dracula strategy starting to be done for us by the candidates. But it's only going to be a success if all of us, actually, in our own communities, both do the macro education campaign, get the word out. And there are a lot of really clever ideas of posters, things you can wheat paste, fun ways you can get the word out on tradewatch.org and exposethetpp.org. Also on our Twitter account, we're constantly announcing different campaigns on Global Trade Watch's Twitter account. And then finally, the micro campaign, your member of Congress. If they do not have the votes, they will not have this vote. If they do not have this vote, that is the end of the TPP. Because it is set up such that both the U.S. and Japan have to implement it for it to go into effect. So when we think of our brothers and sisters around the world who did this amazing campaigning in the lead-up of the campaign, they held their governments accountable in really difficult circumstances. Protests on the street in Malaysia where you get arrested for protesting without a permit. Thanks to them, that agreement didn't get done when it was supposed to in 2010. Or 2011. Or 2012, 13, 14. And as a result of it getting done late in 2015... and also because of everyone's great work here making sure Fast Track didn't happen, which was our contribution to that reality, we have it in a presidential election year where we can take it down. And so with that, I urge all of you, when you get home, number one thing to do, think about what you can do each week, because we're going to win on this, and we'll start the turnaround. Thank you very much.
Focusing on war when we gather together like this is so critical because it's so rarely done these days. Kevin talked about these studies that show that nonviolence works better. I wanted to add to that scientific body of evidence with a quote by the great Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu, who said, "It is only when you see a mosquito landing on your testicles that you realize there was always a way to solve problems without using violence." We've talked this morning about some of the positive things, and especially around the Iran nuclear deal. Jim talked about the role of the Friends Committee on National Legislation and all the groups that came together to work with the Obama administration against the big lobby groups like AIPAC, and it was quite remarkable to at least once in our lifetime see the defeat of AIPAC with the signing of this nuclear agreement. There's another win for diplomacy that happened under this Obama administration. Anybody want to shout it out?
Cuba.
That's right, Cuba. How many of you have been to Cuba? Raise your hands. Quite a number of you. And you know that it's still illegal to go to Cuba as a tourist. But when it was even harder to go to Cuba in the 1990s, I started taking groups, just like this group, the Vence Ramos Brigade, was doing every single year, defying the embargo. And they froze our bank account at the Treasury Department. They took our passports. But let me tell you, it was one of the most fun places to go to defy U.S. policy. And there we were. We had taken about, on this particular trip, about 200 people. We were on a beach resort. we were lying on the beach, swimming in the beautiful ocean, drinking mojitos, dancing to salsa music, and all of a sudden we got a call and said, Fidel Castro wants to meet with you. So we all got into our clothes, ran over, had a meeting with Fidel Castro, and he said, you are all such courageous revolutionaries. And we started laughing hysterically. We thought, what a great way to make a revolution with mojitos and salsa. But it was the constant going to Cuba, the constant defying of the U.S. travel ban that gave Obama the confidence to do what he did. And let's recognize that these two very important wins during the Obama administration did not actually come under the Secretary of State leadership of Hillary Clinton, right? It was after she left and John Kerry came in that we actually started getting some diplomacy. Kevin mentioned seven countries, and I thought I'd mention seven other countries, and you might say what they have in common. Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Yemen, Libya, Somalia, and Syria. U.S. has bombed them all under the Obama administration. Unfortunately, despite some of these positive things, despite receiving a Nobel Peace Prize, Obama has continued a lot of the policies of the Bush administration. Despite the fact that he said he was going to close Guantanamo, he could have done it in the first 2 years when he had Congress on his side, didn't do it. And instead of looking quite hypocritical, rounding people up in other countries and sending them to Guantanamo, he decided on an alternative strategy, and that is drones. Just kill them. We at Code Pink, along with groups like Veterans for Peace, have been very active in trying to expose the drone program under Obama. Raise your hand if you've been involved in any kind of protest around drones. So it's not a lot of people because it's one of these wars that people didn't see, still don't see. And in fact, until we started organizing, people had no idea that the U.S. was even using drones to kill people, both in places where we were at war and places where we weren't at war. I wrote a book called Drone Warfare and went around to 200 cities around the country just explaining to people what we were doing and why the government was refusing to even acknowledge we were doing this. And then we started organizing protests at bases in the United States, like the Creech Air Force Base, where the drones are being piloted, where people with the press of a button are killing people thousands of miles away with absolutely no accountability. We also went to these places, to Yemen, to Pakistan, Afghanistan, met with drone victims, brought their stories back, and better than that, we brought some of the drone victim families to the United States to do what had never been done, testify before Congress. Drone pilots have started to speak out. Now there's lots of great drone books that have come out, and there have been very good documentaries and movies that have come out exposing the dilemmas of drone warfare. This has had an impact. It's forced the government to admit it was using drones and still is. It forced the government to put out new guidelines for the use of drones. Whether or not they adhere to that, we don't know. It's forced the government to say that it will be more transparent. And in fact, we have been hearing for months now that any day they are going to put out the numbers of people who have been killed with the drone strikes, not in places where we are at war, but in the other areas drones are being used. Now tell me, are you apt to believe the numbers the government will put out? I think it's important to have a healthy skepticism about this. And as soon as those numbers are out, start asking questions, because they're going to probably give those numbers in the aggregate, not divided by country. And of course, they won't give us the names of people who were killed. And their decision on who is a militant and who is a civilian is based on saying that any male of military age in the areas where they're dropping the drones are militants. So it is good that we are forcing them to put out some numbers, but let's use that as an opportunity to be still not only skeptical, but completely opposed to the use of drone warfare and continue to demand an end to the use of killer drones. Another area where Code Pink is now involved in is to focus on one of the greatest allies of the United States in the Arab world. It is the country that is the largest purchaser of U.S. weapons. Anyone want to shout out the name of that country? Saudi Arabia. Now, it is quite remarkable that for the past 15 years since 9/11, we have not been able to even get the information that came out in a report done in 2003. 28 pages of that report have been classified. And the 9/11 families, year after year after year, have said, give us those 28 pages because they talk about the role of Saudi Arabia in the 9/11 attacks. It is about time we get those 28 pages. There is also a piece of legislation that would allow U.S. victims of the 9/11 attack to sue Saudi Arabia in U.S. courts. It has just passed the Senate. We want it to pass the House. President Obama has said he will veto the legislation. Terrible, terrible. But the Senate has said they will try to override that veto. We need that legislation to pass. We need to be overridden. Saudi Arabia must be held accountable. Now, it's not only Saudi Arabia's ties to 9/11. It is Saudi Arabia's internal repression. This is a country that is number one in terms of beheadings around the world. This is a country that puts people in prison for blogging, giving them 10 years and 1,000 lashes for the crime of blogging. This is a country that has taken young people who were peaceful demonstrators in the Shia minority community in Saudi Arabia, arrested them as minors, and they are now on death row awaiting to be beheaded. This is a country where you could not put a church or a synagogue. It would be illegal for you to do it. It's a country that says no matter how old a woman is, she will always be a minor and need a guardian to give her permission to do any significant thing in her life, where women are not allowed to drive. It's the only country in the world. Is this a country that the U.S. should be allied with? This is also a country that is spreading the Wahhabist ideology, a version of Islam that is the most intolerant version of Islam that most Muslims say has nothing to do with the peaceful Muslim religion that they adhere to. And this Wahhabi ideology is at the basis of Al-Qaeda and ISIS. We must work hard to cut the ties between the U.S. government and the repressive Saudi regime, cut off weapon sales, the weapons that are being used right now in Yemen, including cluster bombs, a weapon banned by the international community, but still being used to kill people in Yemen. Let's cut off weapon sales to Saudi Arabia. There is also the issue of the country that is the largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid, and that is Israel. I want to thank Bernie Sanders for making it okay as a politician to express some kind of sympathy for the Palestinian people. But we have to go so much further than that. We have to challenge Hillary Clinton in saying that the nonviolent tactic of boycott, divestment, and sanctions is something that people should fight against. On the contrary, we have to stand up and support and be part of this nonviolent boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. We have to educate people that the root of the violence in that part of the world is the Israeli occupation, and it will never end until there is an end to the daily humiliations of Palestinians, the never-ending settlements, the demolition of homes, the razing of olive orchards, the invasion of Gaza, time and time again. It will never end until there is justice for the Palestinian people. And I want to end with a plea saying, we let our guard down when Obama came in. We allowed the peace movement to disintegrate. Now we are faced with a time that no matter who is in the White House, and let's face it, it's probably going to be the hawk Hillary Clinton, or if it is Donald Trump, even though he said a couple of positive things about foreign policy, like NATO is obsolete, he too will lead us into new wars. That the only way that we're going to stop the cycle of endless war, if we have an anti-war movement that is not tied to any political party, and if we have an anti-war movement that not only recognizes but does a much better job of connecting with other parts of the social justice movement. We need to be working so closely with the students who come out of college with an average of $35,000 in debt and help them to understand that if they took one weapon system, one unnecessary weapon system like the F-35 and got rid of it, we could have free college education for every student in this country for the next 23 years. We have to work with everybody working for a single-payer healthcare system to say the only way we will get it is if we cut the military budget and put it into healthcare for all. We have to work with the environmental movement to show them that not only is the Pentagon and wars such a grave danger to the environment, but the only way we will have the funds to build the new green economy we need is if we cut the Pentagon budget. You know, Bernie Sanders used to be really great on this and used to talk back in 2002 about the need to cut the Pentagon budget by 50%. He doesn't say that anymore. We have to say that now. Cut the Pentagon budget by 50%. Use that money for the needs we need at home. And not only that, to address the humanitarian crisis in Syria that we are so responsible for. We need to take billions of dollars to put in to helping the refugees, and we also need to say that the United States should bring in not 10,000 refugees, 100,000 refugees. We need to play our part in this crisis, and this does something to address the Islamophobia that is growing in this country. We have so much to do. I want to end with the quote by Gandhi that I love, which is, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. We've been going through the first three phases. Let's go to the last one. Let's win and end wars. Thank you.
And that will do it for us on the ground today. Thanks again to Gerald Horn. Thanks to DJ Wahee for his remix of All Right by Kendrick Lamar. Thanks again to all those who pledged during the recent spring membership drive. And thanks to our engineer, Mike Nasella. Thank you so much for listening. You can reach our show at onthegroundshow.org. That's onthegroundshow.org, where you can listen to all of our shows. Please don't forget to like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. Now stay tuned for Community Watch and Comment, the open mic edition, followed by the news, and then the Friday edition of Don't Forget the Blues with Ida Campbell and Sandra Butler of Truesdale. Raise your voice out there. Peace.